as you look at this, it's almost, it's, well, it's called, it translates roughly as ghost ride or dark ride. And we were talking about how the way that it's set up in the theater, it's the entire wall in the gallery that the image is projected on. And you're sitting there, and the way that the film is done, there is a car in front of you, and it goes in, and then you go in. What kinds of things happen to you when you're going through this dark area, the dark space that he's created here?
Well, Ryan, my first reaction to this, before much happened to me from the ride itself, was to just sense that this was I couldn't get out of. I mean, I was fascinated by it, and just like a ride, once you're on it, you can't get off. And in that sense, it had some of the feeling of dreams when you're in them, and particularly in scary dreams, you want to get out and you can't, that anxiety, and I think it evokes that. And so in terms of the overriding theme of how film art can evoke qualities of dreams, that sense of being on a ride you can't get off is certainly part of it. Another way in which I think this relates to dreams, and this is more of a formal connection for me, is the graininess of the imagery. Maybe it makes me think of dreams because it looks kind of like the dreams in Bergman's Wild Strawberries, which that's sort of my idea of how dreams should be in film. But beyond that, I think the most important way in which this is dreamlike, besides just the nightmarish anxiety that it evokes, is in its symbolic qualities. And I suppose, as in dream interpretation, you can approach the symbolism individually. It's kind of open-ended. I mean, we each have our own associations to it. For me, this ride is kind of metaphorical for the ride through life.
You talked about how there's an aspect of it that seems to be kind of decaying, or right. that you can see kind of the seams that hold the illusion of the horror kind of figures together, mm-hmm. And how those horror figures in it, the ones that maybe were frightening when you're younger, and that kind of were these authority figures that might be scary as a kid, being kind of demonized as like goblins and ghouls and skulls, mm-hmm. now become kind of hokey.
Exactly. And I think that although they're hokey, and in that sense we can say, well, we've grown up and we don't, we're not afraid of those authority figures anymore, just as we're not really afraid of these fake looking skeletons and papier-mâché witches and goblins. The ride, like the ride of life, takes on a different kind of fearfulness, because we see how decrepit the ride is. We see wiring and cracked sockets that look sort of threatening, and we see the struts and machinery behind the ride that make you realize how it all can decay. Just, and so in that sense, there's the loss of magic, and it evokes in a way the return to earth, or the approach of death, I mean, one's mortality.
That's so interesting that you're talking about the loss of magic, as if when you're younger, that magic is what makes things scary or frightening, and then it's the loss of magic that then becomes scary or frightening. That the illusions aren't working anymore, and that the body is kind of somehow becoming, you know, the ride itself is falling apart, as if the body is kind of falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't really talk about the music, what that music does, too.
It's kind of a techno score.
It's a funny techno score. It's kind of minimal.
Mm-hmm.
It's just on the synthesizer, and there's a lot of spaces between the notes, and I think mm-hmm. that those work in an interesting way, in that mm-hmm. there's like, you're not sure when you're going to hear a note, just like you're not sure when you're going to see something in the darkness. There's this, these gaps that are kind of anxious, kind of create anxiety too,
right,
in terms of being able to see or hear.
Right. It's not just that the magic of these figures in the ride are no longer is there, but the images that we look at, because of the periods when it's just dark and we never know when something is going to pop up again, suggest that things are kind of disappearing. And we're not hearing music that sounds like any music that we feel nostalgic about. It's more
right.
strange.
It's yeah.
like some strange, unknown thing that we're approaching, whatever it may be. In fact, it reminds me of this moment that's not up there right now, but when we seem to be approaching on the ride, an image that looks like outstretched hands,
mm-hmm.
and you get closer and closer and closer, and it's kind of terrifying. And
yeah.
there's a feeling of fascination with that, and then there's an urge kind of to flee, but at the same time to just stay there and tough it out and somehow see what happens. And that makes me think of another aspect of dreams that in theory, one of the things that we try to do in dreams is to experience things that we're afraid of in the interest of mastering them. And the fascination of sitting there and watching these outstretched hands that look like they want to strangle you, getting closer and closer and closer, has the quality of just sort of mastering the challenge of something that's scary and just not fleeing.
Right. I mean, you're not fleeing, but at the same time, it's a strange thing because the ghost ride or the dark ride, also you're disembodied. You're not able to move. You're being moved. You're not in control of your movement. You're being pushed mm-hmm. into darker realms or into mm-hmm. darker areas. And a dream kind of pushes you. It's not like mm-hmm. you have your legs in your dream.
There's a loss of agency.
Yeah. yeah, there's a loss of agency. And I think that brings up some really scary mm-hmm. feelings of mm-hmm. loss of power.
Definitely.
Also, John, you were saying?
Well, I was just thinking that, for me, that I wasn't frightened by the outstretched hands at all. And that wasn't, for me, a scary aspect of the film, but rather sort of the crackliness and the darkness and then an image in a nightmarish kind of way. You know, I kind of wonder what it is about the film, what the music, the techno bop, the graininess, the darkness, the images, what is it that gives it the nightmarish or scary quality?
And we were also talking about how the graininess of it, and you can actually sometimes even see pixels, or the crackliness of it. It's as if the technology isn't doing its job of giving us full knowledge of what we can see. It's not only that there's darkness and we can't see things clearly, but that the technology itself is somehow limited and we can't see clearly too. So there's all these different ways that you can feel powerless in there. But we used the word earlier on fascination, and there's mm-hmm. a fascination too, that you are drawn to these things, and there is a sense of probably relief because maybe being on a ride you do know it's a dream. Sometimes you don't know it's a dream when you're
mm-hmm.
dreaming,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
but there's also sometimes the relief when you do see like a the scary. It's the anticipation that makes it sometimes worse, mm-hmm. and the not being able to see it that makes it worse than mm-hmm. really seeing it, mm-hmm. I think.
But for me, actually, the most prominent thing about the whole film is that something familiar, nostalgic, I mean, I remember going on those rides and just maybe once being scared, but mostly just kind of laughing at how silly they were. And now they look, you know, even more decrepit and silly, but the same silly ride has been transformed paradoxically into something
yeah.
scarier than it ever was.
Right.
Partly because of, as you say, Ryan, the technological stuff, the weird music, the graininess, the periods of blankness, but also because of the lighting and the focus on, as I was saying before, the wiring, the sockets, the cracked, broken things, evokes decrepitude. And since these rides were part of my childhood, it's indicative of how symbolic of how at this stage in the journey, the ride through life, things are kind of not what they were. And so it works on many levels as scary, at least for me. And I think a young person seeing this film might have a very different reaction. And
right.
it just sort of dramatizes how, as you've said when we've talked about these works, how open-ended a rich work of art is, as is true of dreams. I mean, if you want to think of this as analogous to a dream, when a dreamer, an analysand, somebody in analysis tells a dream to the analyst, the analysand says what the dream is about for him or her, just as the artist may have comments about this film and the curators and educators may have their comments, but then the analyst contributes his or her associations, and together they create a sense of what this experience means at this time for them.
Mm-hmm.
And in the same way, I think the viewer at the Hirshhorn looking at these films as dreams can say, well, I'm like the analyst in a way. I can offer my associations, my impressions. They may be different from what the curators are saying, and may be different from what the podcast is telling me, but they are part of my creating with the others who have had their say about it, what this work means for me.
I was just going to say, and also very different than what the artist may have originally intended,
right,
in the way in which the art becomes an object of itself.
We're looking at the work by Rodney Graham, Rheinmetall Victoria 8 from 2003. What's really interesting about this work is that we have not only the image, but the actual projector, the projecting the image onto the screen.
Mm-hmm. Ryan, what strikes me about this film is that the projector, the typewriter that's projected in the film is so powerfully visualized. It's as though this were a love object. If you want to think of these films as dreamlike in that the images have a symbolic weight to them, it's kind of reminiscent of the Warhol Sleep film, in which the camera focuses on the loved one. Here the camera is focusing on the typewriter as though it were the loved one. And the image of the typewriter is so changeable and so sometimes glamorous and seductive. There are moments when it appears in these close-ups as though you're looking at a row of Busby Berkeley dancers or looking down a grand deco staircase, and other moments when the camera moves real close on some harsh mechanical aspect of the machine and it appears forbidding and impenetrable. And as the snow falls, I got the sense that this object that we've been gazing on almost adoringly and fast, and sometimes with fear and sometimes maybe with a kind of desire, is being transformed and becoming not so changeable, but more peaceful, and as though it were falling asleep under the blanket of snow. And it's as though the loved one is and you are just at peace with one another. But then the snow has a quality of being like a shroud, and in some close-ups, the typewriter covered with snow almost looks like a landscape, as though the typewriter has merged with the earth, and it's gone. And then there's a feeling of wanting it back. And so, I think in a way, symbolically, this film could be thought of as reflecting the ambivalence of the desire to merge with the loved one, and then the desire to get away from that sense of being totally blanketed in snow, as it were, and to pull back and re-experience the object as a separate being. So others may have a different view of this, of course, but to think of the film in terms of its symbolism, I think can certainly be evocative for me.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, because you've got two machines, pretty much one machine that's job is projecting and the other machine that's job is communicating. I mean, it's a typewriter, and the keys that have the letters that allow us to kind of codify and make meaning and use sentences is slowly being obliterated by the snow. And I guess the snow becomes the mysterious thing for me. It's what is this this thing that makes us forget language, or what is this thing that makes us not see an object? And the projector is kind of projecting this image. We talked earlier about how, in some ways, the fact that the projector is there makes us realize that this image is an illusion, that it's just light and shadow, and that that projector is really the only real thing. And yet, the way that the film has been done, it's so convincing. And I feel like you had said, it anthropomorphizes the typewriter, and it kind of fetishizes it for me in a way, which is it's very shiny, it's very glossy, we really can see the textures of it. Sometimes parts of it are enormous. I mean, the screen that it's projected on, it makes the typewriter really large. And we actually are very small, so when you talked about Busby Berkeley Dancers, it was kind of the same thing. It creates kind of like a almost a cosmic kind of quality to this the typewriter, just by the scale. So, but then you have the kind of the pathetic quality of the machine just kind of going going at its own pace. So there's this, the image somehow is far more glamorous than the actual thing that's projecting it, which is a really interesting thing for me. And I think snow is very glamorous in a way, like what it can. How we had talked about this as being very much about transformation and how it kind of can transform things. And I know, Joanne, you were talking about it having that landscape quality. And
Well, actually, what I was thinking is I love the idea of the larger-than-lifeness of the image. And I think about in a dream state or just within memory how loved objects or your loved people, or in the anthropomorphized way, or this, the old, can be sometimes larger than life within a dream and within within life.
I think you began to touch on, Ryan, and talking about the reality of the projector and the illusion of the typewriter on the screen. I think that this, it's almost like installation art. I mean, we're, it's not just a film.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And we're in this room, and we are experiencing the typewriter as real, fetishized, beloved, fascinating. And then when you think about it, it's not real. It's just shadows on the wall. And the only thing that's real is the projector, which is clicking away in very much filling the room with that sound, and big, clunky, old projector. And so there's that sense of ambiguity, which is real. We were totally taken up, as we are in dreams, with the reality of what was on the screen. And then we're jarred, as though we wake up, to realize that that's just something on the screen. And the reality is this projector with some plastic moving through it. So, and I think that's emblematic or symbolic of an aspect of life that we're repeatedly reminded of by art, and that is that life achieves its greatest richness, I think, when we realize that the concrete reality that we're dealing with is only part of reality, that there's also a continual overlay or interpenetration of fantasy and memory and illusion, in a sense. And maybe the richest kind of experience is what we have in this sort of installation, where we simultaneously are aware of both the illusion that we allow ourselves to fall into and the reality, and we're sort of looking at both of them at the same time.
Is that way in some ways what gives it its power? Is that that we fantasize at the same time as experience its reality?
I think so. And you know, there's a real analogy, if I may, you know, as a psychoanalyst, and since we're offering the psychoanalytic viewpoint, it's quite analogous to what goes on in psychoanalysis when patients typically experience all kinds of fantasies and illusory notions about their analyst, and vice versa to some extent. And as analyst and analysan work through those fantasies and illusions, and they realize what's real about one another, you know, the analyst, for example, may, in his quiet, is listening. He's not being the punitive father who's giving you the silent treatment. You know, as you realize that there's a reality and a fantasy that are coexisting, it's exhilarating, it's exciting, because you realize that this is in its full richness what life is. Mm. And it makes the fantasies and the illusions less scary and confusing because you recognize them for what they are. And it makes the reality less harsh and flat because you know that it can always be enhanced and somehow irradiated almost by these illusions and fantasies. And it's not either or, you enjoy them both. And I think the wonderful thing about this Rheinmetall Victoria piece is that you experience metaphorically that same kind of ambiguity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a sort of a reality that transcends either illusion or concrete. You have both at the same time.
It's also kind of like you can hear a sound, and the sound might be far away from you, and you can think about that sound as far away from you, but that sound is also in your body because your ear is hearing it. Mm-hmm. Your ear is receiving that sound, and your brain is processing it. So it's almost like a way, from what you're saying, it's not only that it's reality and fantasy, but it's also like that...
the bodily and the spiritual.
Yeah.
Is that what you
mean? Or the idea that somehow...
The physical, the bodily, and the...
And it's your... Yeah. I guess it's about how we receive images and how and how the physicality of the images can heighten our sense of them. Mm-hmm. And I think that that projector is so important there because it really is
Well, you almost feel the vibration of it in your body.
It's really,
it's
very physical.
It's not just in your ears, is what I think you're saying.
Yeah.
And I think that's another way in which the reality illusion thing plays out because, you know, our senses bring in things that are immaterial, right? We hear sounds, we see things that are coming in waves and whatever, and it's all kind of out there, and yet our bodies are very concrete. And I think what you're saying is that in this particular work, we experience both our corporality, you know, our physicality, and our sensations that are less concrete and more in the realm of fantasy and almost spiritual quality.
We're looking at a Bruce Conner, Valstrice from 1978.
Ryan, I think that this work really invites us to speak to why it is that the Hirshhorn has invited people from the Washington Center for Psychoanalysis to speak about the psychoanalytic viewpoint in relation to the show, or why it might be relevant. Cary Brower's wonderful essay in the catalog describes the cinema effect in these works. And by cinema effect, I believe he means the way the films have the quality of dreams. A quality that cinema can achieve better than other forms of art. Like dreams, films portray what people can only imagine in a way that feels real because the images are moving in time. We dream images of beauty, of nightmarish terror, or of the fantastic and magical. But from a psychoanalytic point of view, I think in addition to Cary's important point, there's another aspect to the cinema effect, or in other words, another way in which these films are like dreams. This link is not so much about the type of imagery, it's about how film and dreams affect the viewer, the dreamer or the viewer of the film. To a psychoanalyst, dreams typically represent an effort to deal with emotional tensions while we sleep. These tensions seem to result from emotions that are in conflict. The desire for success or for sex, for example, versus the fear of the consequences. In the dream, we create a potential resolution of the conflict, or at least we try to. And we do this by representing our drives symbolically with people and things that evoke emotion in a disguised symbolic way. And from a psychoanalytic point of view, works of cinema and perhaps of all art may be like dreams in that they are creations in which the artist, like the dreamer, seeks to resolve conflicting emotions. The artist may be doing this psychological work consciously, or may, like for the dreamer, the artist may be doing this psychological work unconsciously. And I think that in this work by Bruce Conner, we see symbols that are fairly explicit and maybe cliched, or maybe you can think of them as kind of classic and universal. And symbols that, to me anyway, express desires, sexual desires primarily, and also dangers in a way that is disguised. I mean, instead of the sexual nakedness of the boy's mother, let's say, if this is thought to be Oedipal, we see a flower and its petals, and we see a woman unfolding her dress. And so we get an experience that is sensual and sexual, but it's toned down. It's not literally an image of nudity. And so that makes it more manageable. And this is the way psychoanalysts think that dreams work, to help us manage our emotions and deal with our conflicting emotions. And somehow in this film by Connor, as I look at it, a similar process is going on. I don't know whether Connor intended it. It may have been unconscious.
A few more thoughts about how this Bruce Connor film can be thought of as kind of a classical psychoanalytic dream. It does begin with a boy going to sleep and music creating a dreamlike, lilting quality. Many of the images, of course, are not sexual. Here's a globe, which could mean all kinds of things. It could be the boy's visualizing his fantasies about circumnavigating the globe, or Superman, or whatever.
Or just the traveling of a dream.
Or the traveling, that's true. And here are sheep. What do you make of that, Joanne?
I don't know if he's counting them on the way to sleep. Or...
What about the idea that he's a farm boy and sexuality maybe is associated with barnyard animals when we think about farm boys? And that may be just my idea about the dream. It is Kansas.
But see, I think Kansas is black and white and evokes for me the Wizard of Oz. Mm-hmm. And in a little while we'll see the family that he may be leaving behind in his wishing, or mm-hmm. whatever it is that he would like.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of reminds me still of The Wizard of Oz,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Taking a journey.
And the black and whiteness of...
What do you think about this bonfire, Joanne?
I'm still on The Wizard of Oz, and that's
okay.
That's the scarecrow who...
Of course.
Who...
Okay, here's the silk and the sensual, the flower opening up in a very erotic way, followed by the grown woman, much older than the boy who's asleep.
And the gorgeous music.
True,
right.
True. Gorgeous music, glamorous like this woman unfurling her coat. And yet, in this film, there's so much that is not at all sensual or sexual. There's the locomotives, the trains. There's the image of a train and a stern-looking guy looking up at the train. Here's a conductor of the train. So, in my thinking about it, and this, granted, is just my own associations, the imagery of trains and father figures and so on and so forth. May reflect the danger of this boy's sexual longings, the idea that he may be at odds with the father figure and his great power as symbolized by the locomotive. Do you think that has any validity?
Absolutely, yes. And also, you know, here he is with this image of these, just all the motion of the women with their calisthenics. So I would think that would also be... Mm-hmm. His sexual desires.
Now, from the point of view of dream symbolism, I think this is interesting, because if you look at any one of these women in some of their poses, you could say it's quite erotic, and yet seeing them en masse, it has almost a militaristic, un erotic quality. And that may be an example of what we mean by the way dream symbolism disguises
but
the erotic.
But I actually look at the images of the women as being more the almost cheerleaders.
Oh, uh-huh.
You know?
Well,
and that would be a
that could be sexual, but it's also yeah, but it's also somewhat cleaned up, I guess. Of course, the scene of the hose spilling its liquid into the ground has a definite erotic connotation, and then we see the rock on the cliff breaking away, and it's as though there's something pretty powerful going on. And now we have the scene of the cars slowly gliding away in the water, which is kind of a image that to me suggests the possibility that this is meant to be a wet dream.
And also the artist who comes from Kansas,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Ryan, what do you think of all this? Here we are psychoanalytically associating away. Does this make
any
sense?
Yeah, I think there's every reason that you should be able to read what you want into these images. They're appropriated from old industrials and old education films, and they're pieced together much like you would piece a collage or any images together, so that they're juxtaposed from each other. But the music ties it together, and by tying it together, it allows us to have our thoughts tied together too, and have our own associations. And yeah, I mean, pretty much what you've said seems to be it's about kind of a coming of age dream for this kid who's dealing with sexual issues and urges. And I guess for me too, I find it interesting because it's also a little bit like a time capsule. It also tells us a little bit what it might have been like to live during that time, and just how society in some ways channels sexual energy into different kinds of the ritual of the family, the ritual of high school, the ritual of group activities, into machines. Even the water itself is something that can't be contained and kind of flows mm-hmm. outside of the machines and outside of the societal structures. So
mm-hmm.
I think that parting image of the trucks in the water is an interesting one. It, mm-hmm. it almost is like there's no way to kind of control this energy, whatever it is, that mm-hmm. seems to be kind of flooding mm-hmm. at first out of the hose, but then kind mm-hmm. of filling the whole world.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's an overall comment about what we've been saying. It makes me think that one of the marks of a really good dream or a good work of art is that it seems to be capable of interpretations and meanings that just go on and on and on. And it's as though, my way of thinking, it's as though the artist has been somehow free to allow his unconscious to express itself. And so all the issues that we can resonate with the artist as a fellow human being is dealing with, somehow find their way into the imagery. And in the same way, what we call a quote good dream or a dream that is well remembered is rich and complex and can be interpreted endlessly. I mean, Freud in his dream book goes on and on, page after page of associations to the dreams that he reports. In actual clinical practice, we don't begin to try to exhaustively interpret a dream that way. We try to find the meaning that works for us in the analytic work. And in the same way, I think the viewer at the Hirshhorn can feel free to react to these works in a way that makes them meaningful to him or her, rather than worry about what is the right meaning.
So we're looking at Kelly Richardson's Exiles of the Shattered Star. This is from 2006.
Joanne and Ryan, I love this work. When I first saw it, I just felt like I did sit down on the floor and just take it in. But as I think about it, a dream-like experience, here are some of the things that I come up with. One is that, like a dream, it at first seems entirely real. I mean, we're taken by the
reality of the landscape, but then at the same time there's something strange about it. And of course it's these falling balls of fire. And so there's the ambiguity of seeming real and yet unreal at the same time. Another dreamlike aspect is the sense of conflicting emotions. The water evokes a kind of peacefulness. The flames evoke passion and energy, whether it's sexual or aggressive. And finally, there's the symbolic potential, the many ways in which we can see this film work as containing in its imagery so many possible meanings, as in dreams, compressed and disguised in the form of seductive images. I mean, for example, the flaming balls that are dropping down could represent, I mean, when you think of the title of the work, Exiles of a Shattered Star, they could indeed be exiles in the sense of creatures from a star who are coming to our planet, and refugees from a shattered country. They could be victims falling off the Twin Towers on 9/11. It could be some kind of celestial ballet, which is very peaceful. But finally, the last thought that I have in response to something you asked me the other day, Joanne, that I think that this could be a wish fulfillment dream. In a way, I think it is, because although there's the conflict of the peaceful water and the fiery objects coming down, the objects, the flaming objects, descend into the water gently and somehow disappear into the peacefulness of the water. So it's as though this is if this were a dream, it would be a dream in which the dreamer were attempting to deal with flaming passions, if you will, and was finding some sort of resolution in the image of water as a destination and as a soothing presence.
Well, in that way, I thought, I didn't think I was going to say this, but it could evoke sperm. Uh-huh. And the idea of making love in a very gentle or passionate, both, mm-hmm. way. Mm-hmm. Also, I was thinking about Anselm Kiefer's work, Sternfall, this summer at the Grand Palais in Paris, and the Sternfall, the stars falling celestially, mm-hmm. Being from Kabbalah, that there is something for me very celestial in this work.
I certainly agree with you. It's the idea of making love, of the overall feeling of this film, unlike let's say the one with Fay Wray beholding King Kong. It's not agitating. It's not nightmarish at all. It has an overall peaceful, resolving quality. Maybe it's. I mean, you could almost think of a if it post-coital repose kind of feeling about it after you watch it a while, and it's. Maybe a work that does reflect some kind of successful resolution of conflicting feelings. Both are sort of happening at once. There's the peaceful scene. We even have the sound of the birds as right. dawn advances, and what could be more evocative of a peaceful new day and optimism, and the passions are there very much in all their glory. I mean, they're flaming, and they keep coming. They never stop, just like the drives, you know, our bodily instincts. And yet they're managed within the overall image and in our experience of this work. So in that sense,
yes.
I think it is a kind of wish fulfillment that has an almost cosmic quality to it, in that you maybe you can think of it as a creation in the sense of a baby. I mean, if you know, following up on your sperm imagery and associating freely,
yes,
you could say that this is this work itself, which is almost as though it's born out of water, because the overall sense is that this is
gorgeous landscape.
A gorgeous landscape. There's water in the lake, there's water in the clouds of the sky. This energy, and the whole film, the whole work, the whole experience is the artist's baby, you could say. And sometimes, you know, when an analytic session really clicks and analyst and Alessandra are talking together about a dream and creating meaning and giving the dream a sense of special value that the two of them share, it's like creating something, and it's a very important part of the analytic experience. And
right.
I think that in some ways this work is not only evocative of the cinema effect that Kara Brower talks about in the sense of being dreamlike, but also evocative for me of other wonderful experiences.
What I would also just add to the idea of this being a creation,
mm-hmm.
or to the creative process occurring in analytic work or in dream work, is that then again, that the work in and of itself, from a an aesthetic reception perspective,
uh-huh.
has a life of its own to be then interpreted in numerous ways by anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
somebody could look at this and be frightened or be delighted or be just enjoy it,
mm-hmm.
or have a multitude of emotions,
mm-hmm.
very different from whatever the artist originally intended,
mm-hmm.
or the curator sort of thought about, or
mm-hmm.
that we may be speaking about now.
Mm-hmm. No, it's so true. I mean, there are people who look at certain works of art and they say, oh, that's beautiful, and others say, oh, it's sentimental and it's too sweet. And people look at, let's say, a Francis Bacon work, and they say, it's horrible, it's gruesome, I can't stand it. And someone else may look at it and say, it's just beautiful, look at how the paint handling transforms it into something so sensual and beautiful. So ultimately, you're right. I mean, the viewer brings his or her own sensibility to it. But as we were saying in discussing one of the other works, an interesting work of art is interesting because it does evoke so many different responses. It's not formulaic, it's not pat, it's not pre-digested, it's open.
Right. So this one, for a half hour, really all that changes is the lighting,
mm-hmm.
or the shadow. You can see this, the landscape as it's reflected in the water right now.
Sunshine moves across the...